We're not good at talking about death in our culture. We may be even more reluctant to talk about suicide, and it's an issue that needs attention because numbers continue to rise. Nearly 43,000 people die from suicide every year in our country. That sounds like a lot, and it is. That means an average of 117 people commit suicide every day in the country. An array of organizations works to bring that number down. They include Lines for Life, based in Portland. It is one of several organizations that is part of the Oregon Coalition for Responsible Use of Meds. We have representatives from both with us now. Emily Moser is with Lines for Life, where she's the Youth Line Program Manager. Emily, thanks for joining us on The Exchange. Okay, there she is. Okay. And Elizabeth White is with us. She is the statewide coalition coordinator for the Oregon Coalition for Responsible Use of Meds. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Hi. Emily, let's start with you. Give us a sense of how big an issue suicide is for teens right now, since you run the Youth Line program.
Well, first of all, thank you for asking the question. It is a really important issue. In the state of Oregon, suicide is the second leading cause of death amongst teenagers for ages 10 to 24. So it's a very serious issue here in Oregon and nationwide as well.
What's the first leading cause of death? I'm curious.
Accidents across the board.
Okay. So, and I understand that Youth Line is actually staffed by teens for at least part of the day.
Yes, Youth Line is a teen-to-teen, peer-to-peer help, support, and crisis line. It is staffed by teenagers from 4 to 10 every day. They take calls, texts, chats, and emails. And when they are not there, which hopefully they're in school when they're not there, the phone line is answered by our adult crisis line volunteers and staff. So it does operate 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
Just not always with teenagers.
Right, because there are times of the day when they really should be elsewhere.
Right.
Talk about the training for the teens. I'm really curious about how much work has to go into them before you let them loose on the phones and text and the other methods of contact.
Well, I'm really glad you asked that because they make a pretty serious commitment. They spend about 45 hours in what you might consider a classroom-type training, where they're certified in a suicide prevention curriculum, as well as youth mental health first aid, and then do a lot of role playing and learning around the types of issues that we see on the lines, ranging from suicidal ideation to active, young people that are actively suicidal, kids that are using really unhealthy coping mechanisms to make it through the day, and then some young people that are dealing with the types of issues that all of us deal with: stress, anxiety, grief and loss, potentially bullying, issues around identity as well. So they go through training to learn all about those issues. Then they spend about 10 more hours on what we call listening shifts. So they're actually in the room, seeing how everything operates and watching some of the other teams collaborate before we let them loose on the line. Which, of course, they're always supervised by a master's level clinician while they're working with us.
So there's a third party on the line, in essence, when that's going on?
There's a third party in the room, and when they take phone calls, there's always a supervisor on the line. It's primarily for the safety of our callers and our young people, to make sure that we give both the callers on the other end the best quality of care they can possibly have, and keep our young volunteers in a comfortable and safe place while they're helping.
All right, Lines for Life, as I mentioned, part of the Oregon Coalition for Responsible Use of Meds. Elizabeth White is the statewide coalition coordinator. How much is suicide tied into drug abuse, Elizabeth?
Well, I think I would let Emily answer that question. She's probably better to talk about that.
All right.
Well, in terms of the connection between drug and alcohol abuse and use and suicide, there is definitely a higher risk of suicide if somebody is using or currently using when they're in that kind of crisis state. Yes, it is something that is connected.
All right, so Elizabeth, I want to come back to you and talk about the kinds of drugs, which may be bigger problems than the rest.
So the Oregon Coalition for Meds, we are a statewide coalition, and we're launched to prevent the overdose, misuse, and abuse of prescription medications. And we usually focus on opioids, like Oxycontin, hydrocodone, because those types of medications are the most abused and misused in Oregon and across the country. So those are the type of medications that we've been focusing on. You would call them painkillers.
Is the coalition an outgrowth from what used to be called the opioid prescribers group?
So there, in Southern Oregon, there's an Oregon prescribers group that now is called the Oregon Pain Guidance Group.
They kept the initials, I noticed, OPG, yes.
Right, and we are actually, our OCRM group, our information is housed on their website because we are a strong partner with them. They are based in the Medford area, and the group in Southern Oregon really did take the lead on providing a repository of information for the community and the healthcare community, and formed a prescriber group that involved not only the healthcare but the community to adopt safe prescribing standards for Southern Oregon. So when we talk about safe prescribing standards, we look to Southern Oregon as a model. So they really have taken the lead under the direction of Dr. Jim Shames, who's the Jackson County Medical Director. So we tap him a lot for his expertise.
We do, too. He's been a guest of the program many times. But so you've got sounds like a number of different groups involved with trying to make people healthier without the use of drugs, all connected through the coalition.
Correct. We are statewide. We are based in Portland, Oregon, because that's where Lines for Life is. We include all different public agencies and healthcare and other members. We sell substance abuse. And we the way we go out and try and bring awareness and to bring change is through prescription drug summits. And we bring all the community together to discuss this issue and figure out best practices for moving forward. And actually, our last summit was on October 27th at the Mill Casino in North Bend. And so we had people from Josephine and Coos and Curry County attend. We had almost 300 people with sponsorship of Western Oregon Advanced Health. So the situation in those areas regarding opioid abuse is very dire, and the community was very interested in discussing next steps.
We're talking to Elizabeth White, who's the statewide coalition coordinator for OCRM, which is the Oregon Coalition for Responsible Use of Meds. Emily Moser is the Youth Line Program Manager for Lines for Life. So we're talking about substance abuse and suicide prevention in one conversation. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Emily Moser, I want to come back to you to talk about the calls into the phone lines or the other contact. And I'll make it clear as we go on that it's not just phone calls. When people contact Lines for Life, are they often under the influence of something?
Typically, no, they're not. Mm-hmm. Most of the people that call the lines, and I want to clarify, we have several different lines. We are the affiliate for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. So if you call 1-800-SUICIDE, in Oregon, you would get us. And that really is a suicide hotline. We also run a statewide military helpline and are one of the four backup centers for the Veterans Crisis Line nationwide. We also manage an alcohol and drug helpline and then the youth line as well. So typically, when people call us, aside from the A&D, the alcohol and drug line, they are potentially in crisis, but not usually. I mean, occasionally somebody it has been using, but I would say most of the time they're really more in a crisis or a high stress place.
You mentioned having a master's level therapist there. So is there often a handoff if the situation goes beyond just the need for someone to talk to?
Well, it depends on the nature of the call, and we have all of our supervisors are at the master's level in terms of their practice and their profession. However, we do train a variety of volunteers. We have approximately 55 teenage volunteers on the youth line and around 125 volunteers on our adult crisis lines, and they go through even a more rigorous training. Our supervisors are all there if needed, and particularly there are times when we need to call emergency services. So we've got this collaborative effort where supervisors and volunteers can work together to make sure that we get the best quality of care to the person on the other end of the phone.
What is the most common age group to contact you? I know you have the special programs for young people, but I also was reading about where the age skew tends to be in suicide generally, and I'm just curious to know who tends to contact you the most.
We don't always take that information because it's a confidential line. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we ask for age, so I can't give you a definitive number. I would say that our age groups kind of fall in line with what the standards are nationwide, mm-hmm. In terms of not all of our callers are suicidal, but when they are, I mean, it kind of follows the same course as what's going on nationwide.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, too, about the connections to Youthline in particular, because as we've alluded, it's not all phone calls. You also do text and I think a couple of other avenues as well. And I wonder how much you've had to adjust strategies because of the fact that people talk to each other differently now.
That's a really good question. I'm glad you asked it. We do offer text and chat and email for for the adult lines as well, but it is particularly used on the youth line. And, yes, the conversation looks a little bit different, and you don't have the same sort of capacity to take cues, obviously, from somebody's voice. So there's some different strategies that we use, but that's the way teenagers primarily talk these days, is via text. So we have transitioned very well, and the number of texts that we get when we have teen volunteers on the lines is actually really high.
And I wonder what the call volume is over the course of a year, and what's been happening to that volume over recent years?
So with the overall, on all of our lines combined, last year in 2015, we took over 55,000 calls. We are expected to, that number is expected to increase for the year 2016. And on the youth line, last year we took approximately 7,500, or we had about that many contacts via phone, text, email, and chat. And this year it looks like we're on track to take over 10,000 contacts on that line.
All right. So
that's a lot.
Yeah. So it's still an upswing. Any idea what some of the drivers are between the continued persistence of people in crisis?
Well, I think our biggest hope in that area is that more people are reaching out for help. That need it, that we're making great headway in terms of reducing stigma around mental health-related issues and suicide and drug and alcohol use, and that we're doing a good job of encouraging what we call help-seeking behavior. So when somebody recognizes that they might be in trouble, that they're actually reaching out for help, that, I think, is probably key to the work that we do, is helping people understand that when you need help, ask for it, and that we will help you get through your crisis and connect you to resources potentially in your area that will help you get through more than that day or the next few days.
Now, if the people they're making the requests for help from don't really know what to do, if they're asking parents or somebody else who's not a professional, what should that middle person do?
Well, I think the best thing that a middle person can do is, particularly if you don't feel like you have the skill set to help in the moment, is connect them to a crisis line and make sort of a soft connect, and or to somebody that, particularly if you're talking about like a youth, for example, helping connect a young person to a trusted adult, somebody in their life, like a coach or a teacher or a parent or an aunt or an uncle, that they actually can identify that they trust and would talk to, and then help them connect to that person.
Now, I've heard from previous conversations on this program that we should not be afraid to ask directly. I mean, that you can't make people commit suicide if they're not thinking about it already.
That's absolutely true. It's a good thing for us to be talking about it. It helps to raise awareness and reduce stigma.
All right, so we're not going to put ideas in anybody's heads. Don't be afraid to say, you know, are you thinking of hurting yourself?
Exactly, exactly. And it's actually better to ask the question directly, because hurting yourself could mean a lot of different things. So it's as scary as it might sound initially, it's better to say, are you thinking about taking your own life? Or are you thinking about suicide today?
So what are the numbers that people should call if they need help, if they are in crisis? What are the numbers to get a hold of Lines for Life?
Well, it depends on, there's several lines, but if for a suicidal ideation, if you're really feeling suicidal, the National Suicide Lifeline is the best number to call, and that is 1-800-SUICIDE.
Okay, and what does that come out to in
273-8255.
Okay. That's the big one. We're talking to Emily Moser, who is the Youth Line Program Manager at Lines for Life, based in Portland, which is part of the Oregon Coalition for Responsible Use of Meds. We also have Elizabeth White with us, who is the statewide coalition coordinator. So we're talking about suicide and substance abuse in the same conversation. You can join that conversation, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So either one of you, what are the suicide aside for just a second, actually, let's come back to suicide. I want to ask the warning signs for that and then the warning signs for substance abuse.
Okay, so when you're thinking about or when you're noticing that somebody might be thinking about suicide, a lot of things that you could look for or would be considered warning signs. One would be that they're actually talking about wanting to die or kill themselves, talking about feelings of hopelessness or having no reason to live, talking about feeling trapped or unbearable pain, or feeling like they're being a burden to others. As we discussed earlier, this idea of increasing use of alcohol or drugs, like a change in behavior with regards to something like that, using more than what you would normally see. People that are potentially sleeping too little or too much, people that are withdrawing or isolating themselves from others, and potentially showing rage or talking about seeking revenge and displaying extreme mood swings. So it's really about noticing a change in behavior, and some of those are very obvious things. Another warning sign would be wanting to give away personal possessions. So sometimes people want to put things in order if they're thinking about taking their life, so they decrease that burdensomeness to others.
Interesting. So then what are some of the issues that we should look for when people are abusing substances? Elizabeth, do you have some tips to look for there?
Well, some of the things that Emily talked about, and she can chime in around that, around opioids, for people who, you know, have a prescription from their doctor, if they, you know, anything that Emily said that resonated with them, to go and please talk to your doctor, because unfortunately, you know, opioid dependency can happen even with a legal prescription from your doctor. And so just always having that conversation with your doctor if you are taking prescription medications is important. And I'll let Emily say if there's anything, other kinds of warning signs, but it sounds like the same type of thing you would be looking for if you need to seek help for a substance use disorder.
And with drug and alcohol abuse, there's some things that you may be harder to notice unless you are the individual, but it's seeing a change in behavior that could impact your life overall. So if you're, as an individual, you're kind of focusing in on drug and alcohol use, and it has a very direct impact on your life on a day-to-day basis. So things like you're missing work because you're hungover, or you're forgetting things because you're drinking, or you wake up in the morning and the first thing you do is take your pill or want to take a drink, those kinds of behaviors as well.
I noticed several organizations, Emily, trying to change the belief that more suicides happen during the holiday season. What is the truth?
The truth is that the holiday season, we do not see a major increase in suicidal ideation or people that are actively suicidal. It really is an epidemic that can occur at any time in your life. A lot of what happens is really around what's going on in somebody's life and creating sort of this perfect storm for the potential to be able to take your life. So, I mean, yes, the holidays could have an impact on that, but it's a little bit more complicated than it's just the holiday season. It's really around what's happening personally in someone's life while it's the holiday season. Does that make sense?
It does. So, I mean, it may deepen something, but it's something that's already there, I would assume.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the best way to put it.
So, Elizabeth, just in terms of trying to get opioid drugs under control in the state of Oregon, we've been talking about it for a few years now. You mentioned the great turnout for the session on the coast a couple of months ago. Does it seem like you're turning a corner now in getting opioid prescription abuse under control?
There's some mixed news. We've got, you know, some good overdose numbers in the Portland metro area that, you know, there's some decline due to distribution of the opioid reversal drug Narcan through needle exchange and other venues. So that's helped in the Portland metro area. I know Josephine County, their rates of prescribing these medications, they used to, you know, be notorious for not having those good numbers, and there are reductions in that, and so that's a success. So there's various successes across the state, but if you look at the data, unfortunately, it's not a big slope. It's not, you know, taking a huge turn. Mm-hmm. So we still need to take bites out of it and, you know, trying to figure out what's the thing that's going to make the change. We're just chipping it away. And
a lot of work ahead, then we can see that.
And
yeah,
prescription drugs are unusual in the sense that this, you know, for opioid abuse, the source is a prescription. So
okay.
Do get them.
Elizabeth White is with the Oregon Coalition for Responsible Use of Meds. Emily Moser with Lines for Life. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Okay.
Thank you very much for having us.